science.
What have you been doing?
I've been hanging out in my shed.
Ah, yes, the Cosmic Shed.
The Cosmic Shed.
And actually, the Cosmic Shed does deserve a certain amount of mention. It always deserves mention.
Yeah,
a Cosmic Shed, I should point out, is that Andrew presents and produces a podcast every week called The Cosmic Shed. And, well, not every
not
week.
Not every week.
Every, when he gets around to it, actually, that's the truth. Yeah. It's a very good listen, and his emphasis is on science fiction, as opposed to this programme, which is all on science, with a few science fiction discussions when it's relevant. But Andrew's Cosmic Shed is all about that. And I understand you're up for an award.
Yeah.
That you can't afford to pick up.
that's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah.
We're
up for the Bristol Life Awards, the creative finalists, no less, which is very exciting. We're delighted to have been... whittled down from 441 applicants or something, and the Cosmic Shed is right up there as a finalist in one of the most creative things in Bristol, which is very... nice accolade to get. Unfortunately, the tickets for the award ceremony are not favourably priced for a podcast where whenever we have made money, we've given it to charity. So it's not something that we can really fork out.
The business doesn't produce those kinds of tickets. But very well deserved, and big congratulations to you.
Thank you very much.
Definitely deserve that. So we hope that... we hope that it comes to something.
Yeah. I can imagine them, announcing. The Cosmic Shed is the winner.
Yeah.
And they're not here.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
I once won a Wall's Ice Cream Swimming Award.
You really?
Yeah. When I was 11.
Okay.
And that's it. it is somewhere.
Very.
But I admire people who win awards.
Could you possibly go in my stead? And then if we do win, then you could be the person who went up to collect it.
Absolutely.
That would be amazing.
That would be good.
Thanks.
And I'm just back from Qatar, as one is.
Yes.
Over the week, a weekend trip to Qatar.
Were you sorting out the World Cup stuff?
I finished varnishing the stadium.
Amazing.
Stadia.
Yes.
You want to be a Latin snob. I was there for FameLab, because FameLab competition is coming up, which is... in the first week of June is the big final at the Cheltenham Science Festival. And so now all over the world, 33 countries around the world, people are preparing for their FameLab competition, which is a competition which encourages early career scientists to be better communicators. And one of the things that happens, and I'm one of the people who goes and runs training workshops in these 33 countries, one of the things that happens is when we get some finalists, so the Qatari finalists were all there, and we give them a two-day training workshop on how to be better communicators, which don't laugh, but that's what I do in my spare time when I'm not doing this.
Yeah, no, I think that's a suitable job for you.
Yes, thank you very much.
How is your Qatari? Is that what they speak?
Qatari is, fortunately, is Arabic.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
That's the good news. The bad news is I don't speak Arabic either.
Oh, dear, that is a shame.
Yes. It's quite interesting, actually, that there are various... I was saying to them, if I wanted to learn Arabic, and... there's some interest in learning Arabic, because I often do go to an Arabic-speaking country. What should you learn?
Hmm.
And the consensus... Now, I don't know, I might be doing something really bad here, saying this on the air, but the consensus was, from various people from different Arabic-speaking countries who were there, Egyptian Arabic, which is a very special form of Arabic... it's very distinctive. Mm. Nevertheless, if you learn Egyptian Arabic, it seems that most people can understand you in the Arab-speaking world.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So there you are.
How are your Egyptian Arabic classes going?
Really, really badly.
Oh,
yes.
Sorry.
I can say shukran, which means thank you.
Oh.
Anyway, let's get on to some science news here, because that's so I've been listening to talks all weekend about science, but this is a story which Jonathan Amos put out on the BBC, which is the famous Boaty McBoatface submarine. Set for its first voyage, and I thought it's just worth talking about this because it was a big joke. Everybody was saying, "Well, you know, we've got this ship. What shall we call it?" And all the votes came in, and Boaty McBoatface was nominated, and then the name went up the list, and everybody thought, "What a terrific joke this is!" And you know, we did it. Nevertheless, of course, the boat has a serious purpose, doesn't it? Just drop it in. Yes, so Andrew, you talk about this now. So this is the story. The yellow submarine named Boaty McBoatface is set to leave for Antarctica this week on its very first science expedition. It's a robot. It's a robot boat, and it's going to map the movement of deep waters that play a very critical role in regulating the Earth's climate. So this is something which I don't understand terribly well, but water is not just water. It's moving in different currents around. And, of course, one of the most famous currents is the Gulf Stream, which comes up from Mexico. It comes up and it bathes the western coast of Great Britain and Ireland. It accounts on its own for our current. And there are many other currents at work in the huge oceans around the Earth. And Boaty McBoatface is going to look at the Antarctic ones. It has the name Boaty McBoatface from a public poll, it's actually a £200 million polar research vessel. The government did think that it would be inappropriate to direct the this name to the £200 million boat, so they gave it to the submersible robot instead. It was a concession.
I can kind of see that it works better for for that, can't it? It's called Boaty.
Yeah,
it's a bit boaty. It's its own thing. It should have a name. It's a robot. It should have like a name.
And the ship. I mean, the ship itself was called the David Attenborough, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So there you go. Much more honourable name. Yeah. These machines can all be configured slightly depending on the task that they are given. And the one that's going to initiate the adventures of Boaty will head out of the Punta Arenas in Chile on Friday aboard Britain's current polar ship, the RRS James Clark Ross. After whom the Ross Straits were named. So we look forward to that. I've got another. Basically, this is a story to say that the boat is being sent on its first expedition, and it has a serious purpose. One of the things that I wanted to look at, and we'll perhaps talk about this after we've had some music, the BBC has been doing a whole series. This is bang on your territory.
Oh, yeah.
BBC has been doing a whole series this week. It's worth taking a look at. But as long as you come back to BCFM afterwards, all about Mars. And do you manage to catch any of this? These are radio series.
I have, yeah. I've heard... I'm not sure who it is, but there's a series of 15-minute programmes retracing the track, the path, the route that the Martians took in the H.G. Wells classic, The War of the Worlds.
Ah, yes.
Which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. I've heard Professor Monica Grady on the chances of finding life on Mars. And there's loads of programmes out there. It's really wonderful.
Now, Monica Grady is famous for being the incredibly enthusiastic lady.
Yes.
In the scene from the control room when I like to think of it as landed the Philae probe on the comet.
Yeah.
Gerasimenko. Yeah.
She is. And she's a wonderful person who speaks incredibly well about science and knows an awful lot about planetary explanation, space exploration, really. She's done a wonderful program on the chances of finding life on Mars, which I recommend to anybody when you finish listening to this and then getting Bristol home on BCFM radio.
John Ford just popped in to tell us a word which I've instantly forgotten. Can you remember? It was ha. It began with a ch. And he said it's the most. He might pop in again in a minute.
Come
if he's
back,
listening.
John.
Come back, John. Tell us what it was.
You.
But I must say, we were talking about John Ford last week, and I was going over his filmmaking career, which is quite impressive, and the fact that he was born. Oh, here
back,
he is. Look, he's appearing in the studio.
John,
what was it?
Mic,
what was
John.
It again, John?
Khalas.
Khalas. Khalas. Which basically means finish. So if you're bartering. That's the most important word to use. It's really good to have the presenter of the next show available.
Yeah. Yeah, more from
to tell us
more words from John
Arabic vocabulary.
In after that.
And we were looking at his filmmaking career last week, and it's amazing how good he is for his age, because he's well into his hundreds
now.
Doesn't
he look good?
He does look good.
Yeah.
And his memory's going a bit, because when I mentioned it to him, he had no recognition. You could see no glimmer of remembrance,
really?
Of all those movies he'd made
I'm
with John Wayne.
I think it might have been a different John Ford.
Do you think? I mean, that is a possible explanation for what's gone wrong.
Yeah. Well, maybe he can explain in the show.
He could do. Anyway, thanks, John, for the Arabic update. Don't forget, as Andrew said, just stay tuned for John Ford for getting Bristol home after the news. So, there's a... The next story that we've got up is that... Oh, I've got some connection troubles, it tells me here. But that's just me, not let alone the computer. is this the story we're going to do? Yes. Could fast radio bursts really be powering alien spaceships?
Yes.
And the answer is yes.
Yes.
So, what's this all about then?
Well, the fast radio bursts, or as astronomers call them, FRBs, because they haven't got time to use the full words, they are something that we've been picking up on the huge radio telescopes that we have around the world. We have a few here, one in Jodrell Bank in Cheshire, which is very close to my heart. There's the Parkes Telescope down in Australia, which is, from the film The Dish. You'll know that if you've seen that. But these huge radio telescope dishes that collect radio waves from outer space. And they have periodically, that's actually the wrong word, but they have from time to time discovered or picked up these huge bursts of intensely powerful bursts of radio waves from space that, with the exception of one, don't repeat. So there's just an incredible burst of radio waves. If these radio waves were being created by the sun, then the generator that would create the electricity to send it out into space would need to be twice the size of Earth. So that's the kind of power that you're thinking about, is hitting the Earth periodically from the depths of space. And the truth of the answer to the question is we don't know what's causing it. There is one, as I say, there is one fast radio burst which has repeated. All of them.
So this is the kind of thing that SETI would be interested in, the search for extraterrestrial life.
Yeah.
So they're looking for these kinds of strange anomalies all the time. Yeah.
But the problem is that they have one but a fast radio burst, then they point back at that part of the sky and they don't get it again, apart from this one instance where they do. But every other time it makes it impossible to study, because obviously once it's gone, it's gone. So how do you study? You need things to repeat, really, in astronomy in order to study them. So we don't know what's causing them. There's a paper that's been published in a journal which I can't remember at this particular moment. Malcolm will help me with that in a sec, by scientists Lingham and Loeb. And they've been looking at whether it could be aliens. And their idea, and it sounds crazy, but it's a real kind of scientific way of looking at it that they've done. Their idea is that these radio bursts could be being used by alien races, alien species, to power huge solar sails, huge light wave sails.
And of course, we should just say, because we don't want to go all tabloid here, that this is pure speculation.
Yeah, no, completely.
There's absolutely no evidence for it at all. But it's just one. It's interesting to think that is a possible explanation.
Yeah, I think it's quite a fun thing to think about. And it is feasible. It's possible because we don't know. And the idea is that they would use these huge, whatever it is that sends out these radio bursts to power, effectively essentially like the wind powers the sail, but using radio waves to power the sails, to blow the sails through space. And whenever that the path of those waves hits Earth, obviously we pick it up with our radio telescopes. In the sense that that's a scientific thing that could possibly happen, it's perfectly sensible. The problem is, there's a big question there. Do these aliens exist, and are they doing it, or is it something else? And some of the things it could be also, but equally we don't know that it's these things. So you know, they're not more scientifically possible at the moment. Things like neutron stars orbiting. So neutron stars are massive stars, massive in the scientific sense, massive, lots of mass in them, which have collapsed down to the point where the protons and the electrons are essentially melting and becoming...
Yeah. They're just short of a black hole, aren't they?
Yeah,
really.
Exactly.
They're on their way to becoming a black hole.
And if they would collide with each other or collide with a black hole or become a black hole, if they became a black hole, they would shed their electromagnetic shields or fields.
Yes.
And that could send out these fast radio bursts. But then why would that repeat? We've got one that repeats. Why would that happen?
And there are some objects, aren't there, in the sky. Is this a pulsar that I'm thinking of here? That clearly is an enormous thing, which is spinning at a tremendous speed, like a lighthouse, effectively, as a lighthouse effect.
Yeah.
The energies involved in that are unimaginable.
Yeah, no, yeah. Completely. I mean, the distances these things are away from us, and the fact that we pick them up so intensely, powerfully.
Yeah.
If you've never seen an artist's representation of a pulsar, you do have them look online. It's just they're a real thing out in space. Just huge stars spinning at thousands of times a second, with huge bursts of energy being thrown out at either side. And obviously, where that energy collides with our radio telescopes on Earth, we pick it up as a pulse.
Mm. Okay. Well, one of the things I wanted to mention, we're going to have an interview in a minute, but just before that, I wanted to mention that the BBC was doing this series on Mars, and it's well worth a look. It's BBC Radio 4. One of the programmes I heard last night, and I wanted to get your take on this, was a discussion about, it's called Cells and Celluloid, a Science and Cinema Special, which will be on the BBC iPlayer on Radio 4. It was Adam Rutherford getting together with Francine Stock, who does the film programme on Radio 4, and with a team of people and a live audience, and they were talking about the relationship between film and science.
Sounds like a good idea.
And you would love that. I know you'd love this. And they were saying, well, the question they started with, which was absolutely fascinating, and these were all audience questions, why is it that in film the aliens pretty much 99.9% of the time look like people? They're humanoid.
Yeah.
And I think probably the answer to that lies partly in the fact that you've got to get actors to play aliens.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, that's
part and so of it. There's an economic imperative there.
Yeah, but also they're made up by people.
They're also made up by people. But it does present, doesn't it, this rather strange problem that we have when we're talking about science fiction. Or, sorry, not so much even science fiction, but trying to imagine aliens, whether or not you use it for fictional purposes. Trying to imagine anything that is highly intelligent and reflective, that doesn't look like us. It's part of our own, our own arrogance as beings, to imagine something that perhaps looks like a gas or a blob or something is very hard.
That's interesting, because I think I probably read and watch enough science fiction that I feel like that's not true for me. It doesn't feel like that. I feel like I'm much more likely to think a kind of anomal, you know, strange blob in space is more likely to be intelligent than, say, for example, a politician.
Well, I let's not go there right now. So, of course, if you look at the animal world, a lot of animals look extremely alien, don't they?
Bees playing golf, for example. We had them last week.
We did. Bees playing golf.
Not that playing golf is kind of the ultimate in terms of intelligence.
That wasn't the strange thing.
No.
No. But, absolutely. Well, look, you very kindly did an interview for us
about
a politician, with Dean Burnett, who writes for The Guardian.
Yes.
And just set this up for us.
Okay, so Ben Carson, who you may have heard of, he's an American politician, has been in the news this week because he's been speaking. And as a general rule, when Ben Carson speaks, it gets in the news for one reason or another. And fairly often when he speaks, it upsets the scientific community. As Ben Carson is a scientist, he's a neurosurgeon, of some repute, and he's been speaking at a conference, and it really upset a lot of scientists, particularly scientists who understand how the brain actually works. And in fact, Dean Burnett, who's a neuroscientist and writes for The Guardian, wrote a piece called "Why You Should Not Let Ben Carson Drill a Hole in Your Head."
Yes.
So I managed to catch up with Dean and ask him about that. But first, I asked him about the book that he's written, which has a particularly suitable title.
It's The Idiot Brain. It's my first book. It's all about basically all the things the brain does wrong in terms of, you know, trying to puncture the mystique. Like I say, I'm obviously a big fan of the brain and work on it a lot. I'm not a big fan of the mainstream presentation of it. It's like it's the most amazing thing ever. You cannot criticise. You must bow down in awe. It's marvellous. It is brilliant, but it's not perfect.
This week, Ben Carson, not for the first time, Ben Carson, the American politician, has said something which runs contrary to scientific understanding. I remember a couple of years ago he said, despite all the archaeological finds to the contrary, he believes that the pyramids were a grain store for Joseph. That's Joseph from the Bible. Now, you could forgive him for that one, because he's not an archaeologist, he's a neurosurgeon. But he stepped into the world of brain science.
I could take the oldest person here, make a little hole right here on the side of the head, and put some depth electrodes into their hippocampus and stimulate, and they would be able to recite back to you verbatim a book they read 60 years ago. It's all there. It doesn't go away.
My PhD is in essentially how memories are formed, the actual structure of them, and what the role of the hippocampus is in this. The thing he has described is not possible, given current technology, and given what we understand about the brain. Doing it the way he's described it shouldn't be possible at all. Of multiple reasons, in that the hippocampus is sort of what stimulating is very important for memory, but it's not for memory retrieval of that level of specificity, in that it doesn't do that. It retrieves like more recent memories, it helps with that, but it's more to do with forming memories, laying them down, rather than fetching them, for want of a better description. But also the idea that when you read a book, every single piece of information about the book is stored in your head, isn't how memory seems to work, as far as I understand. We remember big pictures, emotional details, like resonance and the gist of things, but the human brain doesn't store data so efficiently and so thoroughly, because it can't. I mean, that would, you know, given everything we experience on a daily basis, the information comes from our senses, that would overwhelm us really quickly. So, you know, I think the problem is the word memory is used a lot these days in a technological sense, like, you know, the memory on your computer, the memory on your phone. But that's just a data storage. It's still, information goes in certain files, and it stays there until you need it later when it's retrieved in the exact same form. But that's not how human memory works. It's a lot more to do with emotion and experience and context. We don't passively remember data. We remember things which are important to us, like things which are emotionally charged. They tend to be easier to remember. Things like, you know, your first kiss, or the big first fight you had with your partner, or you know, traumatic events, or really happy childhood memories. And the brain actually edits memories as well, so it tweaks them and changes them. And the more you retell a memory, the more it changes over time. eventually someone, you know, someone says they caught a fish this big, they don't necessarily, not necessarily lying, they actually might remember that, even if they didn't. So lots of biases, like things the brain has to make us feel better about ourselves and more confident. It tweaks our memory to support this view. And yeah, so it's very flexible, it's very plastic. And then we have short-term memory, which is really short-term, lasts like a minute at most. You can only hold like four things in it because it's not really meant for storage. It's for processing. It's where the information comes in. What we do with this, push it somewhere, put it into the long-term memory. That's when actual physical memories are formed and they just last all our lives. It's a question of whether or not we can retrieve them later. If it's like an important memory, it's not given any significance and it's harder to fetch later on when you need it. Whereas really important things, with a lot of emotional context and situation to them, they, you know, far brighter memories because they're much easier to get. There's a lot more connections made with them. So yeah, it's a real sort of, you know, it's not an intuitive thing. It's a sort of not a logical procedure really. It's just what we've evolved to do, and we do it. So yeah, so you know, but in many cases, the reason, you know, the thing is he's described isn't possible.
Okay, that's a great shame for the science fiction fan in me. It's also a bit worrying. Then we've got somebody here, Ben Carson, who's a scientist, and what he says, even in the science that he's an expert in, so, you know, in inverted commas expert, he's wrong. He doesn't understand the brain, the way that the brain works. Do you have any insight into how we get people running the world who don't understand science, even if they're scientists?
The Ben Carson thing is an interesting example because he is a qualified neurosurgeon. That's, you know, that's beyond doubt. He has, you know, he trained in medicine. He has done brain surgery. That's a true fact, you know, that is what he's done. But it's a different thing, like medicine and neurosurgery isn't the same as neuroscience. It's about looking at certain parts of the brain and learning how to cut them out or sort of surgically remove or attach or make relevant incisions. And it's really quite, it's a different skill. It's not, you don't really need to specifically understand how the brain works, just need to know what bits of it are where. Sometimes more like being a mechanic, very precise, very, you know, detailed mechanic, but nonetheless, like there are certain tools and systems in place to make this work, with understanding how it works and what it does isn't as important. I mean, you could argue, you know, some neurosurgeons probably do know a lot more about the brain than the average person or maybe surgeons do, but Ben Carson's history, he's became famous for an operation to separate conjoined twins, conjoined the head and sort of by the nervous system. And if you look at the actual details, they survived the surgery, but it didn't exactly go well for them. They're never the same again. They didn't recover and become fully functional people. But anyway, put him in the media spotlight, and some colleagues of his said it never went off him. So you can sort of see how some sort of God complex would come from that. You know, I'm a brain surgeon, I separate these, I'm amazing, I'm brilliant, and then you surround yourself with people who don't correct you, who don't criticize you. That's a big thing. Like, and obviously people who are, you know, very powerful and rich in things, they think they can determine reality around them. It's like, well, no one ever disagrees with me, so I must be right. And then, you know, the way the brain works is we respond to confidence, and, you know, people, we prefer people of our own sort, so rich people like other rich people, and powerful types like other powerful types, and then they sort of reinforce each other, and then they end up in positions of authority, and we end up with situations like this, and it's not great. It's not ideal.
No, it's not. Thank you so much, Dean. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. Cheers. Thanks, Andrew.
And that was Andrew's interview with Dean Burnett of The Guardian.
You're listening to Love and Science on BCFM Radio.
We are looking at more science stories, and there's one which has come up again. This is carried by the BBC, which is all about... it's actually something really old. It's the heading is How to Supersize Your Memory, according to science. But in fact, people were doing it centuries ago.
Yeah, no, it's a funny one, isn't it? I mean, it coming off the back of the Ben Carson thing where, you know, people talking about brains in a silly way and not really understanding how they work. This is a kind of, it's sort of intuitive. This is how your brain would work. Anyway, the story is that they've done some studies and found that, you know, when you hear these people or you see these people or you hear about these people who are memory champions.
Yeah.
They've got that way because of hard work and practice.
Yes.
Not because they were born with some special brain. There isn't a difference between their brain and everybody else's brain.
Well, this is tremendously encouraging, isn't
it? Isn't it? Yeah. And it's sort of... I suppose there's probably some people listening to that who will feel a bit disappointed that they're not... these people aren't some special people.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of how we're taught to think in a lot of ways, isn't it? That you know, superhuman feats are unattainable for all of us, and they're just not. The people get to places because they work hard.
And just to go away from the memory thing, just for a little bit, we'll come straight back to it, but there's much talk about genius, isn't there? You know, people say, oh, such a genius, he invented this and developed that. But when you look at it, it tends to be about obsession.
Yes.
It tends to be, you know, Albert Einstein just spent, I mean, you know, he's a kind of special fellow because we know that in just 1 year he came up with five major theories about the world. But and they were all very, very important papers that he wrote. And that's absolutely extraordinary. That was 1905, I believe. When you look at Albert Einstein, the essential thing about him was he was absolutely obsessed. He just spent all of his time thinking about, you know, what if I travelled on a light beam? What would that be? And so on. So the work's there. And it's not just like, you know, somebody wakes up in the middle of the night and solves problems randomly. He just gave his mind to it.
Yeah, no, quite.
So with memory, I think there's something else going on here, or something similar going on here, that people who have these incredible skills are actually using some quite old techniques. And there's the one that's being pointed out here, it's an article by Helen Briggs on the BBC. It was called How to Supersize Your Memory According to Science. And she talks about the memory palace, or the scientists who are doing the research. A chap called Dr. Martin Dresler of Radboud University Medical Center in Nijmegen. I have no idea if I've started that. I doubt that that's right. Probably like Nijmegen in the Netherlands. And he said, if you use these strategic mnemonic training memory strategies, you can really considerably increase your memory, even if you have a very bad memory at the start. And so he's looking at this thing called the Memory Palace, which is based on mnemonics. So the idea, as I understand it, of the Memory Palace is that you create in your head a palace, a home, a mansion. Yeah. Some place that you know really well. So in your imagination, you spend time walking around in it. So you go in the main entrance. The main entrance way is very clear in your mind. You go into the hallway. You go up the stairs. You go into this room and that room, you know, and downstairs into the dining room. And you can have in it whatever you want. And that's what you create in your mind. Then, when you want to remember something, like the order of a pack of cards or your shopping list or something about quantum physics that you've been struggling with or whatever it is, you leave the key ideas in various rooms.
It's not just me that's thinking Sherlock Holmes, is it? Isn't everybody thinking Sherlock Holmes?
Well, yeah.
He has a mind palace.
He does.
Just to say...
Yes, he talks about it in the TV series a lot, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. 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 I mean, there are all these sorts of techniques that seem to work, and they've studied this, and they've had control groups, and then they've had groups that have been trained how to think by memory champions, trained how to remember things using techniques like... mnemonics, and I want to say Johnny Mnemonic, and I can't say that because it's not all about science fiction.
No.
And
so don't say that.
Okay, sorry, I didn't say that.
Yeah.
Everyone forget that. Don't put that in your mind, Paz.
there we go. It's stuck. And that's a really interesting thing, isn't it? Sometimes when you try deliberately, I'm going to forget that.
Yeah.
It's the one thing you can't put out of your mind. Yeah.
No, absolutely. So the people were trained by these... memory champions, and other people who weren't trained at all, and other people who gave a bit of training to. And the people who were trained by memory champions could remember twice as many things, and that's a jump from 20 to 30 to 60 to 65. Twice as many things.
The maths wasn't really the thing with you, was it?
But yes, no. So it's about twice as much. What I meant was, it's not one to two. That's twice as much, but not an impressive jump. 20 to 30 to 60 to 65 is an impressive jump.
Yeah,
that was my point. And people who didn't get any training didn't improve as much as those people by any stretch of the imagination. So, you know, it's scientifically proven these people aren't superhuman. They've studied their brains as well, done brain scans on these people. There aren't significant differences between their brains and ours.
And the Romans did this.
Did they?
The Romans did this, yes. Oh. And other civilizations have done this. This is not new. This is very old. All right, let's move on to something else. I'm going to talk about living in space, but we'll do that in just a second, because I think naturally, if I can get my computer to punch up. Oh, excellent! I love it when that happens. There's a story which I think is carried by the New Scientist, which is all about how apparently your brain fills in gaps in your hearing without you realizing that it's doing that. So that accounts for the fact that we hear things sometimes that actually haven't been said.
Yes.
And there's a similar thing goes on with eyes. So just to deviate from that for a second, in the middle of our eyes, apparently, there are no receptors. We can't see anything in the middle of our eyes. And properly speaking, without the intervention of the brain, if somehow we could see what the eye is seeing, there's a big hole in the middle.
Yeah.
It's the brain that goes, okay, based on what I can see around about, this is probably what's in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
So we're actually not seeing the world as it is. We're seeing it partly as the brain tells us.
Can I just say, as an amateur astronomer, I just want to say to all my fellow amateur astronomers, those of you who've been at it for a while will know what I'm going to say, but there's a thing called averted vision, which if you're looking through a telescope, when you first look through a telescope, if you're one of those people who's looked through a telescope and gone, eh, I don't really get it, I can't see.
Yeah.
It's because you're looking through the centre of your eye and you can't fill it in quite as well. But if you do averted vision, look slightly off, that part of your vision is much better. And you can actually see things much more clearly. So if you're looking at Saturn or Mars through a telescope in your back garden, right here in Bristol, if you do a little bit of averted vision in your eyepiece, look slightly to the right, I think, or left probably as well, then you'll get a better view. But that's kind of by the by, because we're actually talking about filling in sounds when you don't hear them.
That is extraordinary. Well, thank you for that tip, the astronomical tip. That's good. Well, this is a story which, as I said, is in the New Scientist, and a researcher called Matthew Leonard at the University of California up in San Francisco has been part of a research team that's worked on this. And he says the brain has evolved a way to overcome the interruptions that happen in the real world. Apparently, we've known since the 1970s that the brain can fill in inaudible sections of speech, so a bit like what we were saying with vision. But nobody knows, or nobody has known until now, how it does that. Why it does that. They call it, it's got a name, but knowing the name of something isn't the same as understanding it.
No.
It's called perceptual restoration. So you go, oh, well, thank goodness for that. That's, you know, but that actually doesn't explain it. That's just what it's called. Yeah. Matthew Leonard's team has had volunteers in the laboratory having words played to them that were partially obscured or inaudible to see how their brains responded. The experiment involved people who already had hundreds of electrodes implanted in their brain to monitor epilepsy. So they used a group of people already having treatment. You can see how they got over some of the ethics problems there. And these electrodes detect seizures, but they can also be used to record other types of activity. Apparently, they played volunteers' recordings of a word that could either be faster or factor. So, you know, sometimes you get a really bad phone line and you hear and you can't tell what's being said. That's why we use that code, isn't it? The police use it's got a proper name, but, you know, Sierra,
Foxtrot
and all that kind of thing. That's why, because, you know, you sometimes can't tell the difference between an S and an F, for example.
Is it okay that I can never remember what those letters are?
Yeah, it is.
I just make them up.
In fact, I memorised them once and then completely forgot them, yeah.
Oh.
In my training once, I was asked to give a whole day to a thing called telephone skills training. Can you believe that?
No.
And I spent ages, it took me longer to figure out what on earth you could do in a whole day. It's basically answering the phone.
Yeah.
And in a training course, you think, what on earth can I get people to do?
Next time you do that...
And we learned that code.
Well, the next time you do that, if you can put that code in the garage in your mind palace, then you'll remember it.
I will. Exactly. Very good. I'm annoyed that you've said that, but you're so right. Okay. So anyway, so you played a word that could be, say, faster or factor, with the middle sound replaced by a noise, so the bit that you don't quite get. And data from the electrode showed the brains responded as if they'd actually heard the missing S or the C. But your brain has decided what it is. And it turns out that the inferior frontal cortex predicts what word somebody's likely to hear. And it does it 2/10 of a second, which isn't that not a fifth of a second, before the superior temporal gyrus, another part of the brain responsible for processing it, starts processing. And they took a well-known phenomenon and showed undoubtedly that the brain puts in the acoustics that are missing, according to David Poppel at the New York University. But although this prediction might seem clever, the team found that it has its limitations. The brain doesn't seem to use the context of a conversation to improve the accuracy of its guesses. That is weird, yeah.
I'm a bit confused.
So when they prime people to hear a particular word, for example, preceding the obscured word with the "I drove my car," they were just as likely to hear the word "factor" as "faster."
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's weird. So it's just literally filling it in randomly.
Yeah.
Whatever it feels like at that given moment.
Yeah.
I say it as if the brain is somehow separate to us.
Yes. Absolutely. Here's a nice story to end on, because we're racing towards the end of the programme. If you heard me say programme there, I did actually say programme. And not arboretum. So this is a story about living in space. We were trying very hard, actually, to get the person who's going to give a speech this year at the British Science Festival, a chap called Jerry Stone, and we will try and land Jerry for one of shows. We'll try and get him for next week. But Jerry Stone is talking at the British, not the Bristol, the British Science Festival very soon. And it's all about thousands of people could live in space colonies orbiting the Earth in 20 years.
That's great news. When can we start?
Yes.
20 years, clearly.
That'd be a good place to go. Yeah. One of the claims that he's making, though, which I think is a bit odd, and I do want to talk to him about this, is he said that we could be healthier. And I actually think there are two big problems, aren't there, with living in space that I can immediately think of. One is radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be healthier, but you grow two heads or something, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Seriously, radiation is a major problem. You can't have lead shields at the moment very easily because, well, the weight and the cost and all of it of getting shielding material up there. In fact, even airline pilots and airline staff are exposed to significantly higher levels of radiation than the rest of us terrestrial beings. So that's one. The other thing is weightlessness, though weightlessness is not entirely... I suppose we are weightless, although we do experience a lot of gravity. Mm. There's plenty of gravity in space.
Yes.
But we can have this effect of weightlessness. I would have thought that would have quite a bad effect on your muscles.
It does, yeah, it does. Well, I mean, we can counteract it fairly easily by doing exercise. I say easily, we have to do a lot of exercise in space to do that. But I suppose you'd have to create spacecraft like in 2001 AD and various other science fiction stories and films where they where they have artificial gravity on the space station.
Yeah. No, actually, causing something to spin creates the effect of artificial gravity, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
Yeah.
I'll explain that next week.
Ah, yes, you're going to go away and look it up.
Yeah, exactly. And put it in my mind palace and tell you about it next week. Can I just say, sorry, that I know there's probably somebody listening to this in their car or at home who's just heard that about radiation and thought, hang on, maybe they didn't go to the moon because of the radiation. Yes. So I just want to clear that up. There's a big difference between going to the moon for a couple of days and living in space. And the amount of radiation that they got on the trip to the moon and on the International Space Station is more than we do on Earth, but it's not going to kill you. There's a big difference. Just needed to clear that up before we carry on.
Yeah, so but what you're talking about is duration.
Yeah, no,
so,
exactly.
So so when we go to Mars, for example, which undoubtedly we will, I mean, you and I.
Yeah, after the show.
That journey is going to take quite a long time, several months to do that. A significant problem is the amount of radiation that, passengers would be.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And astronauts would be exposed to.
Yeah. I heard one particular solution to that, which I thought was brilliant, which was that water could be flowing around the outside of the space station or the spacecraft, and that water could actually shield you. I don't know how they've been looking into it. I don't know where that's got to, but it'd be a brilliant solution, that, wouldn't it?
Interesting tale. Okay, well, we'll pursue this more later next week. It's been such a pleasure to have you with us. From Andrew and I, it's time to say goodbye. Don't forget to stay tuned for John Ford getting Bristol home after the news, and have yourselves a really good evening. See you next week. Science.